Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
In some ways, wild edibles kind of self-sorts people by their willingness to go out and do it.
Jill Vance takes us on a foraging adventure around southern Indiana. And no, we're not looking for morel mushrooms. We'll find other wild edibles, mostly greens, that love the damp and warm spring weather. A couple recipes using wild foods with Daniel Orr, a type of wild onion called ramps, are great in a pickled preparation. And you call it a weed, he calls it dinner, dandelion greens plus potatoes and sausage. And before all that, from Harvest Public Media, what could be changing about school lunch rules? Mark Chilla, looking at the headlines.
On Friday last week, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency accidentally posted a report that found glyphosate, the main ingredient of the herbicide Roundup, is, quote, not likely to be carcinogenic to humans, unquote. But by Monday, the document had been removed, and an EPA spokesperson told reporters that the agency wasn't ready to publish those findings. The agency is slated to release its study of the herbicide's health risks by the end of the year. The October 2015 report that was taken offline was marked final. The document's appearance drew sharp criticism from environmentalists pushing for tighter controls on the herbicide. Roundup maker Monsanto cheered the report, saying it confirms the chemical's safety. A World Health Organization body last year declared that glyphosate likely causes cancer. Meanwhile, a class action lawsuit filed in California alleges glyphosate found in Quaker oats should invalidate claims that they make a so-called natural product. Avian influenza ravaged Midwest egg farms last year, causing a hiccup in production that sent prices upward. But the number of hens nationally is now approaching pre-flu levels, and costs on the farm, such as fuel, are holding low. The result, says economist Anne-Marie Coons with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is quickly falling retail egg prices.
So really what we've been seeing is we're expecting a recovery more quickly than we initially anticipated, and a recovery from the highly pathogenic avian influenza last year.
Coons says the USDA now expects retail egg prices to fall 9-10% this year compared to the average 2015 price. And an update from Indiana, where the State Board of Animal Health has lifted the final quarantine associated with the avian flu outbreak in DuBois County. That means farms in the area have been avian flu-free for 90 days. In total, the outbreak affected 10 commercial turkey farms and meant more than 400,000 birds had to be put to death in order to contain the virus. And if you love cheese, well, we have good news for you. But if you love the economy, this might be bad news. As Bloomberg reports, the U.S. is sitting on the largest stockpile of cheese and butter in over 30 years. However, that means the U.S. is not exporting enough, and it looks like Europe is to blame. This year, the EU increased butter exports by 27% and cheese by 13%. Combine that with an overabundance of milk, a drop in prices, and a weakening euro, and everyone wants the cheese Europe is selling. That includes Americans. In fact, the U.S. has become the highest consumer of European dairy products. Americans imported double the amount of European butter and 17% more cheese products than last year. A strong dollar makes it difficult for customers in Asia and the Middle East to buy American cheese, customers the EU has been able to acquire since the weakening of the euro. We've got more news on our website, eartheats.org, and check out the latest podcast post for a list of these articles.
Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard write for the blog. Mark Chilla reads the headlines.
Yep, that's me. Thanks.
Millions of kids eat their lunch at school. Schools in the United States served more than 5 billion meals as part of the National School Lunch Program last year. Each meal has to meet federal rules for nutrition. As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, those rules are up for debate and changes could be coming to the cafeteria.
Oh, should we get some lunch?
Yeah, let's do it.
It's lunchtime at Norris High School, part of a rural district near Lincoln, Nebraska. I grab a tray and school superintendent John Scretta takes me to the salad bar.
You've got celery stalks, chopped broccoli, cucumber slices. This ain't your mama's school lunch.
That's mostly thanks to the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. It was passed in 2010, and it forces schools to switch to more whole grains, cut calories, limit fat and sugar, start reducing sodium, and serve more fruits and vegetables. Goodbye, Sloppy Joes.
Okay, so now we've got our lunch. We're sitting down. I've got a Southwest burger with fresh pico de gallo and a whole wheat bun, some mixed veggies, corn, carrots, green beans, mixed fruit, and a little salad with some lettuce and some cucumber slices and tomatoes.
The new lunches didn't get 5 stars from everyone. Some students missed their old staples and ditched the fancy new lunch. But Superintendent Scretta says the rules are teaching kids how to eat healthier, and they don't have to go hungry.
There's essentially an all-you-can-eat fruit and vegetable bar, and that's on promoting the right kind of calories, because school-age children consume about half of their daily calories in school.
Despite any backlash, almost all schools have made the changes, and studies show kids are eating better. But some schools have seen a drop in the number of kids buying school lunch, especially kids who pay full price. Diane Pratt-Hevner is spokesperson for the School Nutrition Association, which represents school food programs.
It's counterproductive if kids are actually deciding to not even participate in the school lunch program altogether.
The SNA wants more flexibility in the nutrition rules to keep more kids buying lunch. And it appears lawmakers are listening. School lunch standards are up for reauthorization in Congress. Both the House and Senate have plans that would scale back the standards, but they would do it in different ways. Let's take a look at sodium as an example. The Senate says yes, reduce sodium, but do it more gradually. The House says stop, no more sodium reductions. Pratt-Hevner is glad to see lawmakers are willing to adjust.
We're concerned about schools' ability to meet those sodium limits and still be able to provide students an appealing, tasty meal.
Margot Wutan, a nutrition advocate with the Center for Science in the Public Interest, says students started bailing on the school lunch program before the nutrition changes. Regardless, she says it's important to follow through even if schools need more time.
The science is very strong, showing the importance of sodium reduction to protecting children's health.
The Centers for Disease Control say 9 out of 10 kids have too much sodium in their diets. That can raise blood pressure and increase the risk of heart disease later in life. And Wutan says the current sodium standard for lunch still gives kids more than half of what's recommended for the entire day.
The next level of sodium reduction for the school meal programs is not to super low levels. It's just to less super high levels.
But schools can only do so much. Mel Mandelay, the food service director at Norris Schools near Lincoln, Nebraska, says participation has been stable there. Things like more vegetables and whole grains aren't hard to sell. But low sodium is. The food just doesn't taste good to kids compared to what they eat out of school.
Unfortunately, the thing that makes an impact on that is what we're doing at home. And so until the industry can catch up and get the at-home food that people buy to be on the same wavelength, then I think that that's going to be a challenge.
It may be a while before there are any changes. Neither the House nor Senate has voted on their version of the bill yet. And Congress doesn't have to do anything. The current standards will just carry on. Schools do want to know exactly what the rules are for next fall. But nutrition advocates say they'd rather stick with the leftover law than end up with something that carves up the current standards. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Check out the website. It's harvestpublicmedia.org. Spring foraging is all the rage these days. Wet and warm weather has morel lovers putting on their boots and grabbing their mesh bags in the hopes of hitting it big in the woods. But then there are people like Jill Vance. Maybe you can relate.
I have never loved the taste of mushrooms, and I just don't have an eye for them either. I can step in a patch of morels and not see them.
Jill spends a lot of time in the woods looking for other goodies, most of which are easier to spot than camouflaged mushrooms. She's the interpretive naturalist at Monroe Lake and one of the wild edibles experts on staff at Indiana's Department of Natural Resources. I met up with her this week for a foraging expedition to highlight some of the other wild foods that thrive in the spring.
We are right off of the Monroe Lake Dam, across from the Army Corps of Engineer office, so we are in the southwest portion of the lake.
I wore my heavy-duty jeans and some sneakers that I used to mow the lawn. They have mesh, so that might have been stupid. Well, but your shoes have mesh.
That's just fine, yeah.
Let's do it. I'll follow you.
All right, let's go.
What I did not do was spray my shoes and pants cuffs with bug spray. It's tick season after all, so Jill says that is a must. Before we get started, if you can, bring up eartheats.org as you're listening. You can see pictures of all the plants we'll be talking about and follow along with Jill. So, it's a damp day, and the woods are glowing, bright green, with lots of new growth. We walk maybe 20 paces on the trail, and then we stop.
All right, this is a very common understory little shrub that you find in a lot of the woods in this area, and it's called spice bush. And if you look, we're in a little group of them here, and you can see how they kind of, the stems sort of arch over, which gives them kind of like a little umbrella-like shape to the shrub itself. And if you crush the leaf up a little bit and smell it,
It's lemony.
Very distinctive, yes. We get a variety of descriptions for what it smells like. My favorite one is little kids will tell you it smells like Fruit Loops. Like, not like Fruit Loops in your bowl, but if you open a box of Fruit Loops and you stick your nose into the box and you get the overwhelming aroma. And it does have a very lemony, almost a citrusy kind of smell to it. But spice bush, very common. It's a nice wild edible because it's actually year-round. Primarily, it's a tea plant, but you can use this time of year. The leaves are still nice and tender, and really well into the summer, the leaves are still pretty good for this. You can gather the leaves, or you can gather up the little twigs, and the twigs are year-round, so if you learn to recognize this plant, you can come and gather the twigs, you know, in the middle of the winter, and you stuff it all in a little saucepan and cover it with water and boil it for a little bit. And then strain out all the leaves and stuff, and you've got a little tea right there. Spice bush tea, and sweeten the taste. And then going on to a later part of summer, the spice bush will also produce a little hard red berry. And those red berries, you can take those off, you can dry them and crush them into a powder, and it's a substitute for commercial allspice.
Now we leave the trail, which Jill says is okay in an Indiana State Recreation Area. But don't assume that's okay everywhere. She says it's important to know the rules of the place you'll be visiting. All it takes is a quick phone call to the manager of the land to make sure you're doing everything by the book. We take a few big steps over downed tree limbs, duck under some branches, brush away some cobwebs, and we come across a patch of dark green ground cover. Clover.
Not clover.
Not clover.
Good initial guess. Look at those leaves a little bit closer and tell me why they aren't clover.
Okay, well, they're heart-shaped, so clover are not heart-shaped?
Clover are not heart-shaped. No, their leaflets are just round. The three leaflets and the leaflets are heart-shaped mean that this is sorrel. And it is probably one of my favorite of the wild edibles. Now, this is probably a violet wood sorrel. Yep, there we go.
Oh my gosh, underside is beautifully purple.
Yes, it's going to has a very pretty lilac purple flower on it as well. There's another kind of sorrel that's very common in this area that's just going to be green both sides of the leaf and has a little yellow flower on it. That one will work as a wild edible too. You can eat these. I'm going to get you to eat all kinds of new things today.
Okay, here we go.
Put those in your mouth. All right. See what you think. These are for the people who like a little bit of a sour taste to their food. And so sorrel makes an excellent little substitute for lemonade. So just you gather up, you can use the flowers, flowers or the leaves. I've been eating it and drinking it for years, munching here and there. And, you know, I make a few pitchers probably a year.
After I tasted this, I knew that I'd had this as a garnish on some dishes before. A little further into the woods, and halfway down a slope, we spot a darling of spring foraging.
I was so happy to find these.
Holy moly. Is this what I think this is?
I don't know. It depends what you think it is.
Is it ramps?
It is ramps. But yeah, ramps are kind of a trend food And that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's, you know, good because it helps people appreciate what we've got here naturally. It's a bad thing because these guys do not reproduce very quickly on their own. And a lot of the wild populations have just been decimated by the trend seekers who want to come out and get a lot of them. And I'll get one out of the ground here. Let's see. Little onion-like bulb here. And I will actually be replanting this one. I mean, it looks like there's a lot here, but there really aren't. You could imagine if somebody came out and harvests these, you know, for a restaurant, they could wipe out this entire population in one go, and that would be it. That's all we would see with ramps here. And the trendy way to prepare ramps is to use the whole plant. And they want to see the bulb and the stalk. Well, that's great, but without the bulblet there, these guys really struggle to rebuild the population. And there's no reason that you have to take the bulb. What you can do is you can come in these plants and you could just slice off the leaves. They're perfectly good. They work exactly the same way. It gives you the same flavor. And harvest responsibly. Don't take all the leaves. You know, take a portion of the leaves.
And then Jill did tuck the ramp bulb back into the ground. Keep an eye out for ramps at your farmer's market. You'll see that she's right. The leaves are typically sold with the bulb still attached and some of the little tendrils of the roots. Our chef, Daniel Orr, wanted to include this recipe as a way to prolong your enjoyment of the ramp bulbs, and then next time you find them in the woods, you know, leave the bulbs in the ground, or you can tell your vendor at the market that you only want the leaves.
We're going to do a pickled ramp. So what we've done is we've cut off these green tops and I've put them in a nice pickling jar, and we're going to make a brine to pour over them, and then we can keep them in the refrigerator for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, a year, and you can utilize that vinegar for the flavor into vinaigrettes and sauces and things, and then you can also pull out the ramps and eat them like pickles, let's say with a cheese platter or with smoked meats, things like that. You can use them on lots of different things. You can also chop them up and put them in a sauce or sprinkle them on top of a roasted fish. So there's lots of ways you can use them. Got a pan on, and we're going to show you how to do a quick brine. All right, so I've got about 2 cups of vinegar, about 1.5 cups of granulated sugar, and about 2 or 3 teaspoons of salt. And then I've got some spices, and today I've got some homegrown bay leaves that I keep in the house all winter and then take out and put in the garden in the summertime. And then I've got a little bit of cinnamon stick, some cloves, some crushed red pepper, and then some coriander and fennel seeds. Just add a little vinegar at a time, and you're going to temper the glass, let it heat up slightly before adding a whole lot of the vinegar mixture. Okay, and you want to get all those spices and the bay leaves and cinnamon, everything down in there. Okay, we're going to seal this. And this is just a standard pickling jar. And you've got a beautiful batch of pickled ramps. Come back in 2 weeks and I'll let you taste them.
You got it. Daniel has a couple different ways to enjoy the ramp leaves in a pesto and as a blanket for fish fillets. His recipes are posted at eartheats.org. More foraging with Jill Vance coming up. But for these wild edibles, we won't need to search any further than the backyard. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
You know, my approach to wild edibles is rarely do I have a whole meal that's made out of wild edibles, but I'll have like a little
touch of something.
Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan. Jill Vance says it was her love of food that really jump-started her interest in wild edibles. She'll surely appreciate this other wild food recipe we've got coming up in a few minutes. I'm with her by Monroe Lake in southern Indiana. We've stepped out of the woods and now are exploring the edge areas, land that surrounds the parking lot and really looks a lot like an overgrown backyard. Jill says these areas tend to contain more diverse plant life than in the middle of a forest. And here is where we find edibles that you might consider a nuisance, or dare I say the W word, a weed.
All right, so this one you want to be a little bit careful of where you touch, because there's a lot of poison ivy right around here, which is a great wild edible if you're a bird. However, growing amongst it is some greenbrier. It is a vining plant, and it's got little tendrils that come off and make a little curve at the end. And the younger leaves on the greenbrier and the tendrils are both edible. They kind of have a spinach-like taste. You can put them in a salad. I've just plucked off some of these tendrils before and just munched on those. It's got pokey things on it. it earns its name. Oh, okay, so here's an invasive plant that's not edible yet, but will be. This is autumn olive, which is a little small shrub. Very easy to recognize on the leaves. If you look in the top side of the leaves, they've got like little dots of silver all over them. And if you flip it then to the underside of the leaf, the whole underside has a silver sheen to it. And we used to plant them. They were planted all over Monroe Lake and other natural areas in the 70s. The birds love the berries, and they pooped out those berries everywhere. And it turns out that this plant has very invasive tendencies. So with the help of the birds, it has successfully invaded a good portion of our natural areas and is proven to be next to impossible to get rid of once it's established. But it will make these little red squishy berries. Little red berries also have like little silvery dots on them. But people will make wine out of them.
She's planning to make autumn olive and wild grape jelly this season. That sounds good. Then we look down. You'll see these everywhere, near the woods, by a sidewalk, in your backyard.
And I know people who like beautiful, perfect lawns hate dandelions, but you should get to love them. They are technically not native to this area, but we also don't consider them invasive because they basically only grow in lawns and waste areas. They don't push anything else out of the way, and you think about it, the grass that most people have in their lawns, that's not native grass anyway. But these were carried all over the world by our ancestors as they migrated, because they're one of the very first plants to send out leaves and flowers. You can find these sometimes blooming as early as late December in this area, and that's very beneficial if you don't have a lot of fresh food available, which our ancestors wouldn't at that time of year. But the dandelion greens, you can use them raw. The younger they are, the better for that. Or you can use them as a cooked green, saute them in butter. Use the buds on the flowers before they're opened. You can pluck those off and cook those as a cooked vegetable. After they open, you can pluck off the open blossoms and dip them in a fritter batter and cook them that way. You can also dig the roots and dry those out, and those are a coffee substitute. Basically, every single part of the plant, except for the stem, is edible.
And so packed full of nutrients. Daniel's recipe with dandelions features just the greens, and they're not the centerpiece of the recipe. Take a listen.
What I've done is I've tossed in my local sausage. What we want to do is to cook the sausage till it starts to brown. That way it develops some of the flavor. You want to, anytime you brown meat, it kind of caramelizes the proteins and the sugars, and that's where you get the nice, rich flavor. I'm going to add some onions. And again, we're going to let those cook for a few minutes. We want them to start to caramelize. I'm going to season this with a little salt and pepper. And I'm also going to add my garlic at this time. Okay, once that sausage and onions have started to brown, you're going to add your potatoes. Now, you could do it two ways. You could either put them raw in here and then cook them a little bit longer, or you can do as I did today, and I have a selection of red, white, and blue potatoes that I've par-cooked, a little bit quicker cooking method. Okay, I also have a habanero pepper, a small little habanero pepper. Now, this is really spicy, but I love the flavor of it. So what I'm going to do to get the flavor without the spice is I'm going to add it whole, and then when it gives the flavor that I want, I can just remove it. Okay, and then finally I'm going to add our dandelion greens. I'm just kind of laying those across the top, and that almost forms a little lid over the potatoes and sausage mixture. I'm going to add a little bit of vegetable stock, and we're going to let that stock cook out a little bit. And now we're going to add the acid to the dish. And what we want to do is create what my grandfather called a pot liquor, and that's the juice that's in the bottom of a batch of greens. And we always put a little bit of vinegar. We even kept a cruet of vinegar on the dinner table that you could add to your pot liquor and drink it at the end of the bowl of greens.
That was one of the very first recipes Daniel Orr made for Earth Eats some 7 years ago. Wow. And now on the website, we have several other preparations for dandelion greens from our team of bloggers. Lots to peruse at eartheats.org. At the end of our day together, Jill Vance spread out 10 different books on her car's hood. She breaks them down into three categories: basic plant identification books, wild edible ID books, and then recipe books. It's important to take one or two identification books with you when you look for wild foods, because if we could make a list of rules to live by when foraging, number one would always be know your plants. And then after that,
make sure you have permission to harvest. Make sure you know what you're harvesting. Make sure you know how to harvest it and how to prepare it. And then also make sure that the area you're collecting from has not been treated with chemicals.
And just as important, harvest sustainably. A good rule of thumb, I've heard, is to pick no more than 10% of any one patch.
You know, if you enjoy these things, you should want them to return. And so you should learn how to do that, you know.
Now we'll end with one plant that we don't want to come back. We want to harvest them all and get them out of the ecosystem entirely. Wild garlic mustard greens, I'm looking at you.
And that's a highly invasive, really nasty plant. It was brought here in the 1700s as a culinary herb and has done very, very well for itself. A little too well. And it's good prepared in all kinds of different ways, and it's usually everywhere. It's my personal nemesis plant, and I can't find a single one here, so go figure.
Ain't that the way with foraging?
So you mentioned clover when we saw the sorrel earlier, so here is actually clover.
Edible things all over the place.
Off.
We included even more pictures and descriptions on the Earth Eats website. And even though we didn't find any wild garlic mustard, I posted a picture so you can keep an eye out for it yourself.
This is edible.
Book recommendations are there as well. Special thanks to Jill Vance for all the great info today. Also thanks to Eabon Binder and Betsy Shepherd, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Don't forget, gotta know the rules of the place you'll be foraging before you go. All right, thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.